Welcome to Trust the Badge.
In this episode, I interview Mr. Genaro Morales, who is a former U.S. Border Patrol agent and a former U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent. Mr. Morales reveals his many stories in his time in law enforcement and shares his perspectives of about how the view of law enforcement today needs to be changed. Mr. Morales, who has a bachelor's in journalism, describes how journalism today isn't what it used to be. Let's begin with an introduction of Mr. Morales.
Hello, my name's Genaro Morales. I'm a retired federal agent, 24 years with U.S. Border Patrol and with ICE deportation. I did 12 years as a deportation officer. Well, actually 12 years as a Border Patrol agent first and then 12 years as a deportation officer. And the first 12 years I was assigned there, the first part of that first seven years, I was assigned to San Diego sector, the Chula Vista Station and the Brownfield Station, where I was doing line watch duties there on the border, U.S. border with Tijuana, U.S.-Mexican border there. So, and then after that 7 years, I went over to the academy there and taught for 5 years. I was in Holland for a year, also doing, deportation liaison, what it was called back then, and the supervisor in the deportations. And then I came back over here to Washington, D.C., and did my last 5 years there in D.C. I was the chief, unit chief for the repatriation division. So I did the travel documents unit. I was with the ICE operations. I was with three or four different units down there. But finally, I got tired of it, and I retired in 2015. So that's kind of my little story there in a nutshell, what I did.
That's a really interesting story. Thank you, Mr. Morales. What encouraged you to become a federal agent?
Well, that was kind of a fluke, really. I think I was a senior in college there. I was going to Wichita State University there in Wichita, Kansas, studying journalism. I got my degree in journalism, my BA in journalism. And anyway, my senior year, I went with my roommate up to the federal building so he could apply for a job with, I think it was with the IRS, if I'm not mistaken. He was a computer dude, a computer guy. So while I was waiting for him to do his business, I saw a flyer that the U.S. Border Patrol was taking applications. So I said, wow. I would like that because, I'd taken a lot of Spanish courses too. I'm from a Hispanic background. So I took a lot of electives in Spanish and I thought, well, I'd like to get a job using my language skills. So I applied and, it was a hiring freeze at that time. I don't know why they were taking applications, it was a hiring freeze. It took them about three and a half years before they actually brought me on board after I applied. So I was already doing work in journalism when I got, the offer. Actually, I did journalism for a while then. Wasn't enough money there, so I started doing insurance, and that's when I got the job offer. So I've been waiting for the job for a long time. So I went ahead and took a kind of an adventure, I guess. I was living down in Kansas, and I moved over to San Diego to be a Border Patrol agent. So kind of what happened there. It was an adventure. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
That sounds really good. And why specifically ICE? As you've done Border Patrol, you start off with the Border Patrol, and if I'm not mistaken, you went straight to ICE afterwards, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So why'd you transfer?
Well, I was kind of at the end. I thought I've kind of done everything that I could think of here in the Border Patrol, and I've kind of had enough of it. Honestly, I was at the Border Patrol Academy. I did 7 years in the field, but as you move up, you have to move out if you want to move up. Otherwise, you'll stay at the same level. I started out at GS-5. Retired to the GS-15, so I hit all the rungs. Some of them went backwards and went back up. But anyway, back to your asking, I figured I'd hit my end there in the Border Patrol, I was stuck in the academy, and then I had the opportunity to jump out and become a deportation officer. So I took it, I actually had to bust back and take a step back with the GS-13. I busted back to GS-12 and became a deportation officer, but actually was very, very fulfilling experience because I learned all about the immigration law that, I had studied about in the Border Patrol Academy, but hadn't really applied it. And as the deportation officer, it's like being a paralegal, I suppose is how you would describe that job. The cases come in, you review them for what they're charged with, the immigration charges, the deportation charges, and then you correct them because usually they're written wrong. So you go review them. Okay, well, he violated this. Well, then this is not the deportation charge that would apply. This is the charge that we need to put on him, to present to the judge, the immigration judge, for a final order of deportation. take a lot of brain power versus a lot of physical power to do the job. You know, you're actually learning what's going on behind the scenes, because the Border Patrol, you just make your arrest. You put, you know, they teach you how to do one or two charges at the station. You know, these are the charges that we charge them with all the time, you know, and you charge them with that and you never see the paperwork again. Well, as a deportation officer, I was receiving that paperwork and I said, well, wait a minute, that's not even the right charge. This is what you can be charged with if the judge is going to give the order of deportation, you know. So that's kind of what I was doing, reviewing the paperwork, getting it ready, giving it to the attorney so that he could present it to the immigration judge and get an order, final order of deportation. And then when I would get, when he got the order of deportation, I would get the file back, and then I would start working with the local country, whichever country he was from, he or she was from, to get him a travel document so that he could get permission to travel back to his country, you know, to be removed from the United States. It was kind of a long process. You know, some of these people were in detention, you know, 6 months, 8 months sometimes. It depends on, like, Chinese. We get Chinese, and we worked them the best, so they kind of like all over the country, they'd bring them to Bradenton, you know, and we would handle them here in Bradenton. You know, we would deal with the Chinese, and we would keep them detained. And after 90 days, we'd have to do a post-order custody review. It's called a POCR, the acronym for it. And you review the case and say, well, yeah, the chances of getting it, you know, you review it. Are we going to be able to get a document? Yeah, it takes a long time for China. So, you know, stay in custody because he's likely to have gone. So we wouldn't let him go. We'd keep him in custody. And then after around 6 months, we would get a travel document for him, and then we would make the arrangements to have them removed. Usually via escort, you know, we'd have two officers. Sometimes I was lucky I'd get to go on that trip, you know, and get to actually do the removal and take them to China or wherever they're going. So I travel all over the world with a deportation officer, taking people back where they needed to go. So, you know, you did the paperwork aspects of it, the office work, but you also got to get out and do the enforcement, the removal part of it too. So that was, it was interesting and very rewarding, I felt like, you know, because you're dealing with people that are desperate to go home, too. They don't want to be detained in jail, you know. So these people are desperate to go home and they're broke. They don't know what they're going to do. So, you know, on some of these escorts, usually on most of them, you know, if I spent that with the guy, because I get to know them because they're detained, you know, and I go visit them once a week to let them know how the case is going. If I got a sense that they were desperate for money, they were going to go home broke, I'd give them. $30 or whatever. You know, we're getting per diem every day for our travel time and stuff, you know, money for food and stuff. So I would give him $30 so that he wouldn't arrive broke, you know. And that was before we would have left, you know, the detention center. I'd give him $30. Okay, this is so that when you get home, you know, you can get your cab, you can call your mom or do whatever you need to do, you know, get some. And then I would buy the meals for him too, you know, if we were traveling. We ate, they ate, and all that, you know. So you try to make them comfortable, so that they didn't create a scene on the plane, because these people that are being escorted, they're high risk. They're not your average person that you can put on a plane by himself and, you know, nonstop flight to wherever they're going. There's a risk that they may do something on the plane. So we would have two officers per escortee, you know, to make sure that everything went flawless and there weren't any issues, you know, on our end. So that's kind of how we worked it. As far as giving them money, not every officer did that. I did, because I felt better doing it, and I knew that I was going to have a, those guys, I'm telling you, they love you for it, you know, because they know that you understand how they're feeling, and it makes life so much easier, you know, because they're all stressed out anyway. You know, the guy going to China, he doesn't know whether he's going to get thrown in jail, you know, and that's been known to happen. They get deported, then they go to jail there in China, you know. So these guys, I had a Chinese I was taking, and same thing. You know, I gave him a little bit of money, and he was all concerned about how he's going to get, you know, if I turn him into the officer here, the court of entry, he would go to jail. I said, I'll tell you what, when we get there, I'll give you your document. I'll let you walk through the immigration by yourself, and we'll be behind you. So I did, and he got through immigration right away, no problem, didn't get thrown in jail. And we got a secondary and all that, you know, got the once over. And by the time we get out to the front of the airport there in Beijing, he was waiting for us. He was waiting for it. He was so happy because, you know, he was convinced that if I had taken and presented him to the officer, he would have been thrown in jail. And there was no real rule, I suppose, that I had to present him to the officers, you know. I just had to escort him and make sure that he got to the country and returned. So I did it that way, and he was happy. He would not leave us alone. He wanted to buy dinner, and he wanted to share the cab with us back in the city. And he was like, the changed man. After we had arrived there, it was quite unique, you know.
This sounds really interesting. Thank you for sharing that story. You kind of already answered this, but were there any other specific duties that you had as a Border Patrol agent and working for ICE?
Yeah, in the Border Patrol, I did the line watch. You know, we would be in San Diego, you got all kinds of terrain. You got mountains, you got hills, you know, you've got water, you know, rivers. So, I mean, you've got city streets, you know, San Ysidro, and you've got downtown San Diego. So, you know, every day you would come into work and say, today you're doing a line watch, which means you're going to be working in the hills there along the border fence. Oh, the next day you come in and say, okay, today you're doing city patrol. So you're going down to Logan Heights, there, a rough area of San Diego, and you're with a unit, like it's kind of like a SWAT team, but we were in sedans in our uniform, regular Border Patrol uniform. But we would go, we would hit the streets and we would look at, and after you've been doing a job for a while, you can tell, I know they kind of call it profiling, but I mean, I could tell, when I first got San Diego doing the job, I couldn't tell how these officers could tell one that's, you know, that's an illegal alien and one that's here legally. They all look the same. But once you've been doing the job, their behavior tells you everything. I mean, you can tell this guy's here illegally. And without even asking him a question, I know the guy's illegal. I go up and talk to him. They run. You know, so you go on a foot chase and you finally catch the guy. Everybody in Logan Heights got a screwdriver in his back pocket or a weapon of some type. You know, they can't afford a gun. They got a screwdriver, a knife, something, you know, to defend themselves because Logan Heights was a dangerous area, you know. So when you go to Logan Heights to do the city patrol, when I knew I was going, because I got picked for some reason, they'd be going down there, and I would get stressed out. I knew something was going to happen, you know. And I did get hurt, actually. I got in a situation where I fell through a window, cut my hand, and was off duty for a few months. And, you know, they compensated me a little bit for it, but I got pains in my hands still today, because of it, you know. But, so, you know, that was, we'd do city patrol, and then you would do local sedan, where you're driving around, and spotting people that are just across the border, and you know, they got, you can spot them, you know, they got weeds in their hair. And I mean, you can just tell as an officer, you become aware of who belongs there, who doesn't, you know. And so we would, you know, we would pull over loads, you know, smuggling loads with people going, trying to go up north, smuggling, you know, illegal aliens, you know, making money off of them, you know. I wouldn't call it human trafficking, but that was traffic for like sex or whatever, but it's human smuggling, you know, the difference, you know, trafficking is when you're trafficking to gain, to abuse somebody, like to prostitute them or something like that, you know, versus human smuggling, they just smuggle people up north and get paid to move the bodies. Traffickers move the bodies and then they enslave them, you know. So we did both, but we were fighting all that kind of stuff down there in San Diego. And, you know, I did that. And, you know, sometimes you would get assigned to a detail. I was on the anti-smuggling unit. You know, we were catching smuggling rings. We try to break up the rings and stuff. You know, we went in a situation once where we spotted a vehicle, a load vehicle, and we followed it, went to a house, put them in this house. And the house was all boarded up. All the windows were boarded up with plywood. And we were able to, you know, get kind of, I don't know how we did it, but we got a peek into the house of what was going on. And once we saw what was going on, we went ahead and we entered. And there were over 100 women and children in this house with no toilet, no food, and for bathroom, they had, you know, like 5-gallon paint buckets, and they were using the bathroom and these things. And they'd been in there for days, and it was so hot in there, and it smelled so bad. When I walked in there, I almost vomited. It was horrendous. The smell was awful. And so we got the PD came out, San Diego PD, and everybody was there. The media showed up. We ended up getting an MCI bus, you know, a big bus, and loaded it up and, you know, brought them back to the station and processed them and all that, you know. But these people were being, I think they were being trafficked. I don't know. You know, it was women and children. You tell me, you know, it wasn't like the working class man here, you know, vulnerable people. So, but, you know, the type of things that we did, I was also assigned to the San Diego County Narcotics Task Force, which was, I did that for, I think, 14 months, right before I left. And I was buying dope undercover, you know, on the street from illegal aliens. You know, I was from Kansas. I wore boots and, you know, jeans and, you know, cowboy shirt, whatever, you know, and I would go buy dope on the street, and then we would, you know, make small buys, and then we'd get them to bring in the big amount, and then when they brought in the big dope, then we'd do the bus, you know, and then we would serve warrants sometimes. About once every 2 weeks, we would serve warrants. We'd meet up, like, in a Walmart parking lot, and we would go and do the enforcement, you know, arrest people out of their house. You know, we hit them at 3 a.m. when they're sleeping, knock the door in and, you know, arrest them, drag them out of the house. They're wanted for drug violation and testify in court, federal court and all that stuff. So it was interesting.
Those are some really interesting stories. Thank you for sharing them. It looks like you have a lot of experience in dealing with many suspects and various tasks on the job. Out of all of these experiences, what surprised you about working for both the Border Patrol and ICE?
Well, Border Patrol, honestly, when I first got on, my girlfriend said, "You're crazy. Those guys are rednecks." You know, she had seen what's on TV, you know, Jack Nicholson or whatnot, you know, on these old TV shows about the Border Patrol, you know, Charles Bronson. And, you know, I joined in 1991, and I was surprised that the Border Patrol agents were young Hispanic men like myself. Probably 90% of the agents were Hispanic, or at least 80% of them were Hispanic, you know, Latinos. You know, and they would say, "How can you do this?" My own brother, you know, became a doctor. He came up to visit me. I'm not getting political, but he was bleeding heart. And he come up, "How can you do this to your own people?" And they're not my own people. You know, my people obey the laws. So, you know, that's, maybe they're yours, but they're not mine. And then he went to L.A. to do his residency. And then about 6 months later, came to visit me. "All these illegal aliens, they're draining the system. They're you know, they're our hospital. They come in, they get treated. And then there's no money. They don't pay for their bills. And we're stuck with the bill and all that. They're really hit." I said, "Well, they're your people, remember? You told me they're not mine. They're your people. How come you're not paying for that?" So it's a drain, you know, on society. You know, the fact that they're you know, they're coming in here and they're tapping our resources when our resources are already full. You know, I mean, we got our own people. And anyway, that kind of surprised me, the fact that, you know, the level of Latinos, I suppose, and the level of humanity, because, you know, even though we're doing a job that's tough and the people on the streets and just give you dirty looks, the local, you know, we're doing a job, in my opinion, is honorable. And it's a job that we've been mandated to do by Congress. And we were just enforcing the laws of our nation to protect our people. That's kind of what we were doing. And the fact that it wasn't as redneck and all that is what I kind of thought it might be when I joined up. But I did it anyway because I wanted an adventure. That kind of surprised me. The humanity side of it, I suppose, and the youth of the agents that were doing the job. And they were just like me, you know, young Latinos.
I didn't know that, actually. I didn't know that majority of Border Patrol were actually 90% Latino.
Yeah. I'll say the old school, you know, the old school version of the Border Patrol, you know, they're a white man enforcing border laws, you know. My girlfriend, she thought that's what I was going to be doing. And I didn't know. I was just going to go do it, you know, because I wanted to eat Spanish, you know. So I wanted to go do it. I kind of wanted to eat adventure. I was young. You know, I was 31 when I actually finally got in, you know. But, you know, like I said, the surprising aspect of it is that there were so many Latinos doing the job, and they were young men like myself. They weren't cowboys and cowboy boots and, you know, all that, you know, Jack Nicholson looking. The reason I refer to Jack Nicholson, he made a movie called The Border, On the Border, or something like that, you know, way back in the 80s. And it was about kind of the redneck of the Border Patrol, which is a Hollywood stereotype. But we're not like that. That's not what we really are. We're good people. We're family men. We have, you know, we all had, you know, families and stuff. And we're just trying to make an honorable living and to take care of our nation, take care of our border. You know, a lot of us weren't military, hadn't done military, but this is our way of serving, you know? So.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really good. So knowing with all of your experience as you're a veteran in law enforcement, what changes would you like to see today in immigration customs and drug enforcement if you worked in that area and Border Patrol?
Honestly, an unshackling of the officers. Unshackle them, let them do what they signed up to do. You got these politicians and everybody, you got the media that's painting them to be these terrible people. And, you know, they're getting a bad rap, and then they got their hands tied. They're not even doing what they signed up to do. You know, you've got them over here doing it now, you know, with the open borders that we got going on. You've got them, you know, buying, you know, bringing diapers, bringing food, you know, caretakers versus going out and doing the enforcement that you're trained to do in the academy. You know, the Border Patrol Academy was the most rigorous academy in the federal system. Well, at least when I went through in 1991, they prided themselves on being the toughest academy. Their washout level was high. You know, you might have 60 people in your class when you go in, and when you leave, you might have 40. The attrition rate was high because the physical requirements, the legal requirement, knowing the law, we had to memorize the law. We didn't have to just know it. We had to memorize it. you know, for a test or a written exam. And, you know, we had little cheat sheet. We do charts, and we were taught how to do little cheat sheets and learn the charts and being able to do all this stuff. But it was all, it was very rigorous. And then the Spanish, you know, I think that's why a lot of Latinos were in it, because a lot of your non-native speakers just failed out because they couldn't learn that Spanish language, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. That definitely to unshackle the agents.
Yeah,
that makes complete sense. Yeah.
I just feel like now they're not allowed to do their job, and it's really hard. I hate that. I seem to ramble off your question, your original question, but yeah, they're not allowed to do their
stories, job. Yeah.
That they signed up to do, you know, and that they're mandated to do by Congress. They're not doing it. You know, they're doing other stuff. They're doing, instead of enforcement, they're doing like support jobs, you know, that they hire contractors to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've done some contract work since I retired, you know, with the feds, with this influx of migrants coming in, you know, doing compliance oversight. So going over to the camp where they got the kids and making sure that they're treating them good, that they're fulfilling the contract like they're supposed to do, you know, these private agencies that are doing that. So, but anyway, back to your subject there.
Oh, of course, no problem at all. So speaking of those changes, do you see any difference in today's immigration control and border patrol compared to before when you were in law enforcement?
Yeah, a lot. As far as, I think, micromanagement, what's going on right now, you know, the officers, when I was going, we didn't have, first off, there were no digital cameras. Nobody had cell phones, you know. So the chances of you being filmed when you're doing your job were like almost obsolete. You know, it was not going to happen, hardly ever, you know, unless you were set up, which I never heard of it. But now, you know, each officer has to run around like he's being filmed all the time when you're out in the field doing your job, enforcement work. You've got to. My impression, you know, I haven't been out there lately, but my impression is if you're not doing your job, you better be doing your job like you're being filmed, because you probably are. Somebody probably got a camera. You're going to be on TikTok, or you're going to be on the nightly news, you know? So, and I think that by having that, it's kind of like a check and balance, I think, by the people, you know, on officers. But, you know, so knowing that you're being filmed, or the captain, you're being filmed or high, you're going to probably cause you to do your job better, you know. That's unquestionable what you're doing. There's no question about that. I'm legally within my bounds, that my actions are unquestionable, you know. So I think it's probably a good thing in a way. But I see a lot of the technology that's going on too, you know. There's a lot of technology in the field on the border that was not around when I was out there. You know, we didn't have all these, you know, because we were even Vietnam era military equipment, night vision equipment and stuff like that. Well, now they're using the hype, you know, stuff probably from Desert Storm. I don't know, you know, but I know it's a lot newer than what we had. You know, they got motion detectors and stuff like that that we didn't have back then, you know. But we had, back when I was doing it, we had like a sensor, you know, we had a dispatcher would call out underground sensor. So when you run by a little sensor, it sets off an alarm, and the dispatch says, okay, I got a hit on the 223. Well, you got to know where the 223 sensor is, and then you got to know where it leads out to and go lay up in front of it and wait for the people to come through, you know. That's kind of how we did stuff out there in the hills. Now, you know, they've got all kinds of stuff that I haven't been out there, but, you know, from what I hear, they've got a lot more technology than what was around when I was out there, you know. So things are better. They're better equipped. I'm not sure about the training. You know, I did teach at the academy for 5 years, but my last 5 years there, but I don't know. I know they shortened the academy and they made the Spanish a lot easier, and they watered down a lot of stuff. They try to make it easier so that they don't fail out so many people, because it's expensive to bring them in and train them, you know. So I'm not sure if the training is as good as it was back in the day, but you know, there's a lot of changes that have happened. But like I said, when you can't go out and do your job, it doesn't matter how much technology you have. If you're not allowed to go out and use it, it doesn't do you any good.
That is something that needs to be talked about more. It sounds like in your experience, you had a lot of interactions with a lot of people, especially with your use of Spanish, using your job to travel and let many immigrants go back to their homes. How often did you have to interact with the American public and the American community? And how often were you seen as bad in general because you're law enforcement? How often was that?
As bad?
Yes.
Well, you know, in San Diego, we were bad all the time. They didn't like it there. You know, this would be back in the 1990s, you know. The public locally, they didn't like it there anyway. You know, you just knew you weren't wanted there because they thought we were outsiders and were there, you know, stopping, I guess, their friends or their people from coming across, you know. I don't know. But we had some situations that almost became riots here at Cedro.
I found that interesting because you're protecting them, and I just find it
really shocking
that they would see this. Terrible.
Yeah, they didn't see that. You know, this is a local. They're Latinos. Mostly here in San Ysidro, probably 99% Latino.
Okay.
And they didn't like it because they thought that we were, I think, occupiers. That's kind of the feeling that I got, you know. I mean, and we would go in, and you know, border patrol agents are taught to ride alone. You know, you don't ride with a partner unless you're in training, field training. Usually you don't ride with a partner. You're riding by yourself. So you're taught basically whatever situation you get in, you better be able to handle it on your own, you know?
Wow.
And yeah. And so you don't bite off more than you can chew. And, you know, if you got to learn how to judge the situation and either step back and say, okay, this is, I can't handle this above myself. I need some backup on this. And so then you call your partner, hey, whatever star number, you know, like, hey, 218, can you meet down here or whatever, you know, and then you meet and tell what's going on. Okay, let's go in and handle the situation, you know. It's more than I can handle, you know. So that's kind of how that went. And it wasn't really with the people crossing versus the locals. There was a lot of gangbanger types and stuff down there, you know, in the area. And, you know, you don't want to get in a room with, you know, 30 gangbangers, then you're in there by yourself, you know, in uniform. Walk around acting like you're untouchable because you're not. Nobody's untouchable. My son is studying law enforcement. Both of them want to be law enforcement officers. And, you know, he sends me videos and stuff, but I see videos of these cops, you know, and they're just like, it's an embarrassment. They're an embarrassment to themselves sometimes, you know, because I see it. They're just like acting like they're the cock of the walk just because they're the cop. You know, you can talk bad to people and you don't. You're supposed, if you're any good at your job, you're going to put yourself at their level. You're not going to act like you're better than anybody because you're not, you know. You always bring yourself to the other person's level, and you're less likely to have an altercation, you know. It's the psychology type thing, you know. You treat people the way you want to be treated. And I think that's something that, you know, my parents taught me when I was a kid, you know. So it's like basic instinct, you know. But some people don't have that, and they get filmed. And you see it on TikTok and stuff, you know? And I say, wow, that guy's an embarrassment to law enforcement. You know, he makes the rest of us look bad. Somebody sees that video, you know, say 10,000 people see it, they're all going to think cops are bad. They're not, you know? That guy's
bad. That's a
bad.
Common issue. Yeah, that's a good thing that you mentioned that, because that is actually a very common issue today. Usually there will just be one video of law enforcement, probably a single law enforcement officer breaking the law, not deserving the badge that they have on their uniform. And most of the time, many people think that that's what every other officer is, and that's really not the case at all. It really needs to be more widespread that, of course, those officers, they will be held accountable, and of course, they will probably be fired. But that doesn't mean that every single other law enforcement officer out there is the exact same.
Well, that's the thing. You know, when you have good moments, officers don't film each other. So, you know, you don't have a film of a Border Patrol agent giving a lunch to somebody that he found out in the hills that was lost for 4 days and starving and giving him his drink, you know, that he brought his lunch. Because he's assigned up in the hill all day long for a 10-hour shift, and he can't get off that hill because he's got to stay up there. So this officer, given his lunch, I'm saying that because it happened to be, I did it actually. But, you know, people do it all the time. You know, officers have compassion. And we see, and we hurt, and we feel. So when you see somebody that you know is starving, you're going to give them your lunch. And you're going to drive down, you're going to drive off that mountain and go to Burger King and get them something to eat because they're hungry, you know? And you don't, nobody wants to see somebody starving, you know? I mean, I have people been praising, thank God you found me. We were freezing up here, you know, because San Diego has different terrain. It's got mountains where there's snow. It's got desert. It's got everything. Beautiful area, at least it used to be. But, you know, I was up in the mountains and I found these people that were up there and they were freezing. I put them in my Bronco, turned the heater up for them, you know, gave them what I had for myself to eat. Here, you guys eat this, you know, and meanwhile, I'm bringing them down, you know, to take them in, because these people need to help right away. You know, they couldn't really wait. You know, I didn't feel like they could, you know. So we do a lot of judgment calls, and we do a lot of humanitarian stuff that never, never, ever gets told, you know. And it doesn't get filmed, doesn't get put on TikTok, because it doesn't make, it's not provocative, you know.
Right, so. And that is funny to mention as well, because many of the time when law enforcement does do the right thing and does do things that are wholesome and are heartfelt, is not very widespread at all, and it's not shown on the media as often either. That is something that needs to be mentioned as well, and it is very unfortunate that has to be the way, as to where it's only the bad things that law enforcement does that is showcased.
Well, you know, I studied journalism. That's what I got my degree in, and I'm glad I didn't pursue it, because what I see now is it's a betrayal to the American people of what's really happening out there. You know, And they're the ones that spread story, and every news outlet out there is reporting it, and it's maybe not even real, you know. It may be a lie. It may not, you know, but they seem like they get an agenda, and they want to push that agenda. Right now, cops are bad. You know, we had the George Floyd thing, you know, which I think is falling apart now. It's being proven that this guy's in prison and shouldn't even be in prison, or, you know, this George Floyd situation. Yeah, maybe, you know, the way he got him down on that neck hole, but then again, if he was taught to do that at the academy, and now you're holding him responsible for doing the way he was taught to do. I mean, what's up with that? I don't agree with that. You don't put somebody in prison for doing his job the way he was trained to do it. You hold the agency responsible. You know, the officer doing what he was taught to do the way he was taught to do it. You know, so I don't know. You know, when I think a lot of the stuff is coming out now, at least I've been reading, you know, that a lot of the George Floyd stuff is coming out, that this guy may be in prison unjustly. And on top of that, he just got stabbed, you know? Did you hear about that? He was stabbed in prison.
I did actually hear about that. Yeah, I heard that he was stabbed in prison. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what's happened with him, but yeah. But yeah, the media, they're doing an injustice to the American people. You know, I studied journalism, and what they do on TV is totally against anything I ever learned in school back in the 80s, actually, when I was in college. So I don't know. You know, I don't know what they're teaching in journalism school nowadays, but hopefully it's not what we see on TV and what we're reading in the papers, because, you know, fabrications and lies just don't cut it with me, you know.
Thank you for noticing that and sharing your perspective on that. In your experience working for both of the agencies, what did you encounter or see on the job that just gave you more motivation for your work?
I'd say probably the human trafficking and the smuggling element of people that are innocent was probably, as a Border Patrol agent, what motivated me more than anything else. You know, seeing people that are being abused, innocent people. I get it. You know, they're breaking the law. They're coming here. But that's a removal charge, you know. It's not a crime. I mean, not a major crime. I don't even see it as bad as like carjacking or robbery or anything like that. You know, I mean, although it is federal law, the level of what it reaches is not as bad as a lot of other crimes. So I just think that the people that are being abused is something that really, really struck to me. You know, I don't like to see people being hurt, you know, physically or mentally, you know, and, you know, women and children especially, you know. And, you know, I was telling you about that load house that we found that had women and children in it, and they were stuck in there for days and without any air ventilation, because the windows were nailed shut, and, you know, the windows were covered with plywood and everything, and then they were given a 5-gallon bucket to use the bathroom in. It smelled horrible. And I don't know where they were going or what they were going to do with these people, but, you know, who knows? Slavery? I don't know. But it wasn't good, you know, and that probably struck me more than anything as something that's wrong that needs to be fixed, you know, and it struck to me, you know, pulled on my heartstrings probably more than anything.
Thank you for sharing that. That is something that would definitely give the person more motivation for their work, is when they see the evil, I guess, of humanity, and then to try to combat that is very brave. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for your service. Going back to the perspective of law enforcement by the media and by the public, what do you think is the most common misconception the community has about law enforcement?
I think that law enforcement is the enemy, that we're thugs, you know, and it is the media. even politicians sometimes will get on their high horse there. And, you know, do you remember a while back where the Border Patrol agents were accused of whipping these aliens? There was a horse patrol with there was a big scandal, and it was all fake. It was all about these agents were, this is how you maneuver the horse, and you use the reins on the horse to actually, the horse is trained. You know, when you use these reins, you move them and you move them around and the horse will move a certain way. Well, the media was trying to say that they were beating these illegal aliens with the reins, the horse reins. You know, it was all fake. And then the politician got involved and it was just a big nothing. Well, my friend, actually one of my better friends, was actually the chief of the Border Patrol at that time. I asked him, I said, what's going on with these guys? You're not going to let these guys get railroaded, are you? He said, no, I'm the Joe Biden can say whatever he wants, and whoever can, Mayorkas can say whatever he wants, but I'm the one who dishes out the punishment, you know. And he was a horse patrol guy, too. He had been on a horse patrol, so he knew exactly what was going on, you know. He said, no, I'm not going to punish him. And he didn't. He ended up retiring, though. I think they forced him out recently, so he's not the chief anymore of the Border Patrol.
But, okay, yeah, I actually didn't know about that story. That sounds like something that definitely needs to be talked about more, of course, with law enforcement being portrayed in such ways. In your opinion, what specific scenarios put law enforcement on the downside when projected by the media? For example, do you think use of force is a common scenario that puts law enforcement on the downside?
Yeah, I do. That's a big one. You know, I mean, the media is all over that, too, because, it gets viewers for them, or it sells newspapers for them. So they're big on that, you know, and I think it's a bad deal that they're making law enforcement the bad guys, because when you're in trouble, who you call? You call law enforcement, you know. That's who you call. You call the police. You call the sheriff when you're scared and you're in a position where you feel vulnerable. You're going to call for a law enforcement officer because they're there to serve and protect. That's always been the motto, and it is. That's why they're there. So I just think that, you know, news media is probably the biggest driver of making the law enforcement look bad. I just do. I mean, you know, whether it be CNN or whoever, you know, I mean, they're all bad, you know, because they're all telling them the same story usually. And it's sensationalism, you know, it's what it's called in journalism. And, you know, we were taught that we don't do that. That's not reporting, you know, that's trying to sell papers. That's, you know, that's what started wars and stuff, you know, I think the Cuban war down there, the Spanish American war down there was all due to newspapers and stuff, you know. So it's not good. You know, the media, I think, has too much power to go unchecked. And, you know, who's checking the fact checkers? Who's checking the checkers? You know, somebody needs to be checking these guys because they're not doing the American people any justice.
Right.
And they're harming, of course, but, you know, and, you know, they push a lot of agendas that hurt everybody, because when you take down law enforcement, you know who's going to take care of you? You better be taking care of you. You better be prepared to defend yourself. And be brave enough to face the evil that's out there, because there's a lot of evil. So, you know, I can take care of myself, but, you know, I got a lot of training, and I'm a good shooter and everything else, you know. And I kind of, you know, I when I'm walking down in public, I know what's around me. I'm always aware of my surroundings. A lot of people are looking in their iPhone; they're not paying attention. They're the people that get rolled and become victims because they're easy marks.
Right. And speaking of how law enforcement is portrayed on the media and, of course, all of these movements, speaking of movements, what does the term defund the police mean to you? And, of course, why shouldn't law enforcement be defunded?
Well, to me, it means chaos. If you're going to defund the police, that means you're going to take away their operational capabilities. That means no gas for the cars, no money for the officers. No money to feed the people they arrest, you know, no money. When you're defunding the police, that means basically you're pro chaos. That means every man for himself. And I hope everybody's prepared for what's coming. Because, you know, if people know that your door is open and you're not home and that you left your safe open and it's full of diamonds, you don't think they're going to go in there and take them? Of course they are. Well, defund the police is that door. They're the ones, you know, that's opening the door. The police are actually what keep bad out of your house. They keep you safe at night. You know, they keep you safe on the street. You know that you can go to the store and you're going to come home alive, or your children go out for a burger and nobody's going to murder them because there's cops out there taking care of everything. You know, when you defund them, you don't know. Your kid might go out for a burger and end up with a bullet in his head because, you know, we're in chaos. You know, and then, of course, then you're going to have vigilante. You know, people out there, okay, we got no cops. That means we're going to go out and take care of business, you know. And then it's basically the strongest, the guy who's well-armed, the best armed, the best shot, the most capable is going to be the one who rules. And you're going to have tyranny. So, no, it's not good at all.
I completely agree. And speaking of the reverse side, do you think there should be more funding for law enforcement instead?
Well, yeah. And I think not only more funding, but maybe, I don't know what the training center, I was an instructor. Like I told you, I was a course development instructor there for the Border Patrol for the last 5 years. I was in the patrol over there in Charleston, South Carolina for 4 years. Then I went to Glencoe, Georgia, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and taught for a year. But I think, because the times have changed, the training needs to keep up with the times. Training needs to keep up with the times. And you know, I think sensitivity training is big. It was big when I was there, but it should be even bigger now because, you know, you have media pushing agendas, trying to drive people against each other, you know, whether it be race, whether it be LGBTQ, whether it be male, female, you know, they're trying to separate everybody. That's what I'm seeing. So you need sensitivity training. You can't please everybody, but you need to be able to do your job and do it in a professional manner and a respectful manner. You know, when you're talking to people, like I said, you need to bring yourself to everybody. You know, you bring yourself to the level of the individual. You don't act like you're superior because you're not. You're a cop. That badge is a privilege. You know, it's not a right to have that badge. You know, it's a privilege and it's also a trust. And you need to live up to that trust. So I think the training needs to keep be brought up to, I'm not like that. I haven't seen any of the training lately. I don't know what's going on, but training needs to be, whoever's doing this training in charge of the training department need to make sure that the training is keeping up with the times. You know, that to be TikTok, the one, like we mentioned TikTok, you know, that's just a quick one, you know, because, you know, a lot of these people, and you got provocateurs out there that are looking to set up cops to make them look bad so that they can put it on TikTok, you know. They need to be aware of these things, that these situations are there, these traps are there, and they need to be smart enough to navigate through those situations without looking like idiots, you know, and maybe possibly losing their job because of it, you know. You get sucked into a trap and somebody makes you look like an idiot. Now you're on TikTok and now you're, you know, a million people have seen you. That's not good, you know. So that your training for those types of areas, you know, with the technologies that are out there, and the fact that everybody's got a camera and a video, public relations, dealing with people, you know, how to handle people, how to handle groups of people, not, you know, and remain in control of the situation because, you know, officer presence is big. Well, a lot of, you know, officer presence being used to be, especially the Border Patrol out there in the field, you're the baddest guy out there, you know. Anybody crosses me, and I don't even tell them you cross me. I don't care if everybody else gets away, I'm going to catch you. And you are going to be the one that pays. You know, and that, the only reason I did that, it was like a scare tactic. So that, you know, you're holding 40 people on the ground by yourself that you apprehended by yourself. And you lay them, you know, what we would do was line them up, you know, set them up, like, sit down on the ground on their butt, and then the next one, right, you know, his legs around him, and the next one just in like a big line, you know, and you're just talking to people and trying to control the situation while backup comes to help you. Even to pat down these people. You can't pat down. When you're patting down one, the other 39 are running away. So you set them all down and control them until you get help to manage them, you know. So officer presence was really big, but, you know, that was a big thing that they taught us at the academy, you know. But, you know, public relations, dealing with people, dealing with special interest groups out there in the field. I mean, we would run into people. I mean, there was a lawyer who made his living off of other people's misery in that he would try to prop himself up. So he would get on the news and you know, get all this immigration business, you know, by making us look bad, trying to make us look bad and make himself look good. He was there for the people, you know, but he was getting rich off of it, you know?
Yeah.
So things like that, you know, and like I said, knowing basically when you're patrolling out there, you just need to patrol like you're always on film, like somebody is filming you all the time, because you probably are being filmed by somebody, you know, that's just the way it is. So it's big, and I'm not sure how they're dealing with it, those training academies, but in my opinion, funding is very important. You can have all the money in the world, but if you don't know how to spend it, it doesn't do you any good. You know,
right.
Funding and accountability is really big too, you know, and the public relations, how the people perceive your agency, how the people perceive your local cop, that's important. Because if the people don't like you when you go out, yeah, you're going to have aggressive encounters just because people don't like you. But if they're out doing things, supporting events and all that, you know, in the public, that goes a long way too, you know. Whether it be, I've seen a lot of things that where cops get involved, helping out in situations, and whether it be fundraisers for a little child with cancer or whatever, you know what I'm saying? These are public relations events that make the whole agency look good, you know. Those are good things, and they need to spend some of that money on things like that, you know, not just enforcement. So training, public relations, and enforcement, of course, you know, you got to have the equipment and the tools to do your job, you know. So, but yeah, I'm pro. Of course, you know, I'm retired, Fed, but I'm pro, you know, funding and even giving them more money, you know. And
that's good to know. Yeah, funding is definitely needed. And I feel like that the more funding that is dedicated to training and, of course, use of force and just other aspects that could really help the agents and officers themselves will overall help their trust with the community, because then the community will know that their officers are well trained and they can have some good trust in them, even though they should already. But that's just an extra layer, and extra funding wouldn't hurt at all. It should ultimately help rather than hurt law enforcement and the community. And for the listeners, what message do you have for any current or future law enforcement listening to this interview?
Well, number one, watch your back, because no one's going to watch it for you but yourself. You know, I mean, whatever situation you get in, first off, you put yourself in that situation. So, you know, make sure that you know what you're doing when you're getting into that. And also, don't follow your fellow officer, rather, you know, lead them. You know, don't become a follower, become a leader. You know, you lead by example, you know, you just try to be the best that you can be. And situations will be everything about how you are portrayed to your fellow officers and also to the public, you know, how you behave and how you react in stressful situations, you know. So, like I said, be alert, you know, watch your back, and also know that, really, you know, you have partners that are out there, fellow officers, but when you're out there, a lot of times you're alone, and you just need to remember that, you know. I mean, help may be 10 minutes away, it may be 3 minutes away, but 3 minutes is the difference between life and death, you know. Always be aware of your surroundings, do the best you can do, and, you know, just try to be the best, and I think you'll do well.
Thank you, and I'm sure they'll take that message. Ultimately, how do we as community and as the public trust the badge?
I would say, as far as what we could do as law enforcement, is first off, we got to vet our people and make sure that they're vetted the best. I mean, when I was going through, we had guys that were not vetted, and then we had people that were, you know, we had bad guys in our groups, you know. I mean, we had people caught smuggling dope, we got people caught having, you know, raping the illegals that are coming through our own agents, you know. I mean, so, you know, you're going to have a few bad apples, but the vetting process needs to make sure that it's as good as it can be before you even bring somebody in, you know. That if you've got good people, and then on top of that, you've got good training, you know, and you screen these people to make sure that their mental health and all that, you know, they're not going to snap and you know, embarrass the agency and embarrass themselves and put themselves in a situation where they could end up in prison. You know, it, all these kinds of things will help make a better law enforcement agency and a better community, you know. So I just think policing themselves as you police the community is important. You know, the police need to police themselves as they're policing the community. You know, you see your partner and he does something that you don't think is right, let him know. Don't do it again. Don't do that again, because if you do, you're going to put me in a position where, you know, I'm going to have to do something I don't want to do, you know. And it's bad because, you know, cops are all about, you know, we got each other's back here, you know, you're a snitch or whatever, you know, because we're at the brotherhood. Being law enforcement's a brotherhood. These people are your brothers. You know, when you're in a situation, who's going to save you? Your brother cop there, your fellow cop. So, you know, you don't want to put somebody in a situation where they have to do the right thing and put a dime on you because you violated somebody's civil rights. You know, you treated somebody wrong, which everybody, you know, clearly your fellow officer saw it and didn't like it, thought it was wrong, you know. So don't put somebody in that situation, you know. Don't put yourself in that situation. So that's how we trust the badge. I think, you know, by the community seeing these cops they're just doing a job that's tough and you know, they're just like us. You know, they're no better. They don't act like they're better. They're just here to protect us and take care of us. They'll see it when they see that, you know, the cops are out doing their job and at the same time they're policing each other, you know. It's a good thing. Everybody wins.
That does make a lot of sense. Of course, law enforcement there to protect and serve their communities, and that needs to be understood more often rather than seeing law enforcement as the enemy, as you mentioned. So before we end this interview, do you have any final thoughts for me or for any of the listeners?
Well, I just think, you know, right now we're in a slump as far as law enforcement, you know, because of the media. I blame the media for it. I do. They're not going to, and people are seeing it, by the way. But, you know, law enforcement's gotten a bad rap because the media, I think they're leftists, you know, and they need to go back to their own, you know, the media needs to go back to old school, real journalism, real reporting, you know, and none of this jumping on the bandwagon or starting to, you know, jumping on a trend or whatever, you know, that they're doing, you know, they've got an agenda and that's not good. They shouldn't be agenda driven. So, I mean, if our media would get their act together, America would be better off, not just the cops, but all of America, because they create a lot of division between people and between, you know, different classes of people and between, well, you know, law enforcement, which is a class of people of its own, in my opinion, you know. So it's just not a good thing, you know. So I wish that the media would just get their act together. And I think our whole world would be better off.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your time today. I really enjoy that you're very passionate about law enforcement today and what changes need to be made, and as well as how we need to see law enforcement differently. So thank you so much for your time.
All right, dude. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Trust the Badge.